Right, so today's discussion, I'd like to move to the next mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of mezuzah, putting up mezuzahs in our houses, which is a very famous, well-known mitzvah. Amongst Jews, I think it's one of the most practiced mitzvahs, you know, even amongst those Jews who may be secular and don't practice every mitzvah. But, welcome. But putting up a mezuzah is definitely considered a very significant mitzvah for a Jew. So we'll go through again some of the basics of what it means to put a mezuzah up on our doors, what doors require a mezuzah, what doors don't, and we'll discuss the message and the meaning of the mezuzah. So the source of the mezuzah comes from Shema. In both of the first two paragraphs of Shema, we mentioned putting up a mezuzah. It says, "Suchsavtam, you shall take these words, you shall write them on mezuzos beisecha, on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." And just the common misunderstanding, the word mezuzah literally means a doorpost. So we refer to that thing on doorpost as mezuzah, it's kind of like a slang, as it were. But the mezuzah, literally, the word mezuzah means a doorpost. That's what it means. So that we put a parchment on our doorpost, and that's actually a mezuzah. The command of the Torah is to write the words of Torah upon our doorposts. What words? What words is it referring to? So it refers to the two paragraphs that actually speak about mezuzah in the Torah. Those should be on our doorway. So therefore, both of the first two paragraphs of Shema, those are the paragraphs that actually describe the mezuzah, and those are the two that are in the actual parchment. So if you're to open up your mezuzah and look inside, you'll see the two paragraphs of Shema in there. We discussed last week how tefillin is four paragraphs. We discussed how the head tefillin is actually four separate parchments. The mezuzah is one parchment containing two paragraphs of the Torah, the paragraph of Shema, and the second paragraph of the Hayah that we say in our Shema. That's what it contains. It's written similar to Torah scroll, so you're using special ink, special type style, etc., written by a scribe who writes it properly. One mistake in the writing renders your mezuzah invalid, so it's very important to have a kosher mezuzah. I discussed with some of you last week of checking our mezuzahs periodically. There's a concept of checking them. We usually say you should check it twice in 7 years is the number given. So every 3.5 years, you should check your mezuzahs. There are people in the area who do mezuzah checking, so it's definitely recommended. And, you know, based on the conditions, weather conditions, moisture in the air, mezuzahs do eventually deteriorate. Sometimes the writing can fade, things can smudge, even though it's inside a case. So it is important to check mezuzahs periodically to make sure they still are kosher. It'd be unfortunate to have mezuzahs on your door for years and years and years and find out that it wasn't kosher all those years. The rule is to put it on the right side of the door in the direction you're entering the room or the house. So on the front door, it's very easy because you come in the front door and you put it on your right side. If you have doors in your house, there is an obligation to have mezuzahs on every door in the house. We'll talk about exceptions, but there is a misunderstanding by some Jews that it's only on the front door. But that's not true. It's on every door in the house should be the mezuzah. And you have to determine what's your common route through your house. It's like, for instance, you know, some rooms you may have two different doors, and you can get into the room in two ways. So you have to figure out, do I more often go this way or that way through that doorway? So I take the way I most often go into the room, and that's my entrance way. And I put it on the right side based on that direction, if you understand what I'm saying. So like a room like this is very easy. You're coming in the room. It's the right side entering the room. But a room that has two or three doors, you have to figure out what's the normal route you would take.
Rabbi,
yeah.
Well,
it depends, because sometimes there's another room behind that you might come from. I'll give you an example. So in my house, I come in the front door. I have on my straight ahead of me, a little to the right, is my kitchen. To the left is the living room. The living room actually circles back around to the dining room and the kitchen. I mean, it's basically a circle, my bottom floor. So to get to the dining room, you may go from the kitchen to the dining room. Or if your normal route is to go from the living room to the dining room, you go from the dining room to the kitchen. See what I'm saying? If I could draw it on the board, I would. I don't have a proper marker for that. But sometimes you have a room, but you think about it, there's two ways that you can get into the room. Is the primary usage of that door to go from the kitchen to the dining room, or from the dining room to the kitchen? That's basically the question. So in my house, I had that question, and I had to determine which side of the mezuzah is on.
So any room that you're going to enter, you're going to be exiting also.
Right.
So the criterion is
the right side and your entering direction.
When you're entering.
Entering.
But you're saying run one room to another. So if you are in the living room going into the kitchen,
yeah.
The kitchen going into the living room.
That's interesting.
Right, so which one do you more commonly do would be the question. Sides. Yeah, no, that's the question. No, so you determine which is my more common route. That's what you try to determine. That's my more common route.
People going into the kitchen, probably going into the kitchen rather than being in the kitchen and going into the living room.
Right, yeah, just, you know, I think it depends on each person's own habits and et cetera.
They live in the kitchen.
A mezuzah only goes in a house with some sense of permanence. So, for instance, if you are renting an apartment or house outside of Israel, Israel is different. So then, if you're going to be there for 30 days or more, it needs a mezuzah. But less than 30 days, it does not need a mezuzah. So if I'm doing a very short-term rental, I'm going to be in a house for 24 days, outside of Israel, I have no obligation to put a mezuzah up at all. That's one point.
Hey.
Welcome. Wow, it's been a long time. Welcome back. If you purchase a house, whether it be in Israel or in America, you need to put a mezuzah up right away. And that's also the mistake some make. Everyone thinks they have 30 days leeway. That's not, if you actually purchase the house or the condo, it's not true. You have to put a mezuzah up right away. If you live in Israel, whether you're renting or buying, you need to put a mezuzah up right away as well in Israel. And the reason for that is because we want to encourage settling in Israel with more of a permanence. So therefore, even rental in Israel is looked at as something a little more significant, and that there you would put a mezuzah immediately as soon as you rent, as soon as you move in. There are exceptions to the rule of mezuzah. Any room which we look at as a room that the activities inside are not honorable does not require mezuzah, such as a bathroom. So there's no mezuzah in a bathroom. There actually are those who discuss rooms like laundry rooms, or if you have a shower in a room without a toilet, but ultimately the bathroom is our big exception. The obligation does include garages and sheds and basements, etc. It's not just, you know, not just your bedroom, things like that. It's any kind of room in the house. For instance, I have a shed in my backyard. I have mezuzah on my shed in the backyard, as long as it's the right size. And just to give you a few more details, and then we'll get to the meeting.
As what's the right size?
Is there some reason
shed or
the shed? The shed.
Is there some reason for not putting it on the bathroom? And is it considered, we say a blessing over going to the bathroom.
Right.
So my question is what was the reason?
But you still would not, you can't study Torah in a bathroom, you wouldn't take a holy book into a bathroom.
True.
So being that's not considered an honorable place for the Torah, you don't put a mezuzah on that door. Now, there are essentially 10 different, we'll call it, qualifications for a mezuzah, in terms of which doors to put it on. And I'm not going to get into too many details in this class, it's not the place for it, but just we should have an idea of it. There are times that a mezuzah would go up, and you make the blessing on putting up the mezuzah. So the blessing there is l'kvo mezuzah. The God commanded me to put to, you know, to fix the mezuzah on my door. There are times we put up mezuzahs out of blessing, and there are situations which we'll talk about that the obligation is questionable, and therefore halacha determines you should put a mezuzah up, but don't make a blessing on it. It's good to be aware of the questions when you have your own homes that you have questions about. You know what to ask the rabbi. Rabbis do make house calls, so if you do have questions in your houses, definitely you can invite a rabbi over to check it out. But essentially, I'll give you just some details that you should be aware of when it comes to putting up mezuzahs. So number one is the minimal size of a room requiring a mezuzah is, the biblical measurement is 4x4 amos, which in our terms would be approximately 6x6 feet, or 36 square feet. So a room smaller than that does not require a mezuzah typically. So if you have like a small closet, so the small closet would not require a mezuzah. That's number one.
2 yards.
What?
2 yards.
2 yards. What did I say? 6x6. Yeah. Right. 2x2 yards. Right. For mezuzah to be an absolute requirement, you need to have actual doorposts there. Two doorposts. And plus what we call, I think a lintel is the word. No, that's called a mashkof in Hebrew. It's the upper part of the doorpost. So without that, there's not necessarily an obligation for mezuzah. There should actually be a door, a swinging door there as well, for it to be an absolute obligation. The doorway should be higher than...
Sorry, you're saying if there are doorposts and a lintel but no door, then there's not an absolute
obligation. You'd put one up without a blessing at that point.
Are you calling this a number three, or is this part of number two?
Which one? Three was the lintel. Four is the door.
Three is okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're going from the living room to the dining room, and it's walls, and it has, and you're saying that you would not need...
There's not meaning you wouldn't put with a blessing. You put without a bracha. Yeah, without the bracha you would. Yeah, with no bracha in that case.
What does it say literally? You should put a mezuzah on the doorpost of your house.
Right.
So how did it progress from the doorpost of your house doorpost of the kitchen, the doorpost of the living room, the doorpost of the dining room? Is it a sale of mezuzahs? What's going on? Why can't it be when you come into that house?
Well, it's the doorposts of your house, meaning all the ones within your house. That's how we understand it.
It's again plural, but
it is plural. I mean, the Torah says it in plural. That's what it says. Mezuzos. Mezuzot.
Would you argue, would you contend that if I have doorposts between my bedroom and the hallway, that those are not doorposts of my house?
Well, they are doorposts of your house, but
answered your question.
But they're not, but it seems to me that the actual definition of a doorpost of your house is the doorpost of your house.
Well, that's why we rely on the special understanding.
What's
if it's not clear.
What's the purpose of it then? Isn't it?
What's the purpose of having a mezuzah at all?
Purpose we'll get to in a minute.
Purpose is no doubt my mind's purpose. But how many you have after you walk in, which is the main emphasis, when I come into a house and I see that mezuzah, I'm really not looking for all the other mezuzahs. I'm looking that I went into a house with a mezuzah on the wall.
We'll talk more about the meaning of it, but certainly the verse says, plural, the doorposts of your house. Right. And many rooms do have still, you do have the side posts and doors, usually a frame. The door frame we're talking about, the door frame. Yeah. You should leave the business. Right, yeah. Yeah, Brenda's pointing out it's an important point as well. If you're selling a home, and the person moving in is Jewish, you're supposed to weave up the mezuzahs, not take them down.
Rabbi?
Yes?
I'm reading all about this transgender stuff. How about transgender mezuzahs?
What?
Temporary homes.
Right. So it depends how long you'll be living there. If you're there 30 days or more, you need a mezuzah on it, as we said before.
30 days
right. So for a sukkah, you don't need a mezuzah. Right. That's temporary. Well, even there, because it's only meant to be there temporarily in the first place. Yeah.
The mezuzah needed when you have a door.
Oh, so let me get back to my list here. So the last thing we mentioned the 6x6 feet, doorposts, a lintel, and a swinging door, an actual door there. So again, these are the guidelines for an absolute obligation, which means you'd put a mezuzah up with the blessing, you know, as a certain obligation. A doorway with no door does require a mezuzah, but you don't make the blessing on it. You just put the mezuzah up without making the blessing. The room which you are putting the mezuzah on is not so relevant to us, but should have a roof. The doorway should be higher than what we call 10 tefachim is the biblical measurement, which is about 30 to 40 inches. If it's a very short doorway, like you have to crawl in, like a crawl space, for instance, that may be exempt from mezuzah. Surprisingly, people don't realize this, the doorway to a shul, to a synagogue, is actually exempt from mezuzah. The customers put them up anyways. We put one up anyways just because it's appropriate, but it's actually exempt based on the primary laws. It's exempt from mezuzah. It's very interesting. I would assume it's because whatever the mezuzah symbolizes, if that whole room symbolizes it, could be you don't need the mezuzah possibly. That's my assumption.
I heard a reason is that it's any place where you eat and sleep that requires a mezuzah. It's not a shul is a place you go use it to pray, but it's not a dwelling. It's not
a dwelling place. Right.
So
place
of dwelling. That brings up another question. What about a sukkah?
Right.
Because a sukkah is a dwelling.
Well, so it's temporary, though. It's a temporary dwelling.
Okay, so it's got to be a permanent place.
Right. I mean, the way that the Talmud describes the exemption of a shul is that the Torah says, the mezuzah of your house coming to exclude the holy houses. You know, not your house, which is your regular house, but that excludes, you know, the shul.
Is this number 7 is an exclusion from the list?
Yes, 7. Or you could say it includes only a mundane home and not a holy room such as a shul or a beis medrash. Then you should bring a mezuzah right away. I mean, outside of Israel, you have 30 days in a rental for a mezuzah.
I can't hear you.
Outside of Israel, if you rent for less than 30 days, you're exempt from mezuzah. But in Israel, you're obligated immediately. That's the difference between 30 days. Yeah. That's
is it the renter or the owner?
The renter. It's not the renter, not the owner. It's the renter's job.
If you're an owner and the renter does
not... It's not your business. It's his job. It's the renter's job, not the landlord.
Come in and say, you should really have a mezuzah.
I mean, just because he's your fellow Jew, but not because you're the landlord. You know, it's not your job as a landlord. Yeah.
If you own a property as rental, is that not considered...
No, because you're not actually living there.
You're not actually...
The halacha is that the one who actually dwells there is obligated. Now, this is actually discussed in the Gemara. This is the person who dwells there.
If you can move back and forth between here in Florida, here in Israel, then you could actually take down your mezuzahs as you go back and forth.
I guess if you're not living there currently, I guess you could. But if you're going back and forth, it's probably not worth the
effort. Yeah, I didn't say whether or not it was worth the effort.
You save some money.
But also, if you still keep things there that you are going to go back, that's also called living there. Even storing things there is called living there. It has to be a place where we call it diras adam, that a human being dwells in, as opposed to, let's say a chicken coop or something, I think would be exempt from mezuzah, because it's not for human beings to dwell in. It has to be an honorable place. We said a bathroom is excluded. And it has to be a place that is built for a permanent dwelling, such that would exclude, like we said, if you're there like in a sukkah, for instance, it's built for 7 days, that's exempt from a mezuzah. Different rabbinic authorities discuss mobile homes and things like that. It's okay, yes, even in Israel, yeah, because the whole building is only built for temporary usage. There's a difference between you living there temporarily versus it being built temporarily. Those are two separate things. So again, there's a lot of details here. A lot of questions come up. I recommend if you have issues, ask a rabbi, and he'll tell you what to do with your mezuzah. But these are just all things to keep in mind as we think about mezuzah obligations. Yeah. Temporary, yeah. Even in Israel, if you're at a hotel, it's okay.
If you live in this room for more than 30 days and it's not your home, what are you doing?
Well, if you're actually a renter in that, if you're living in that room for 30 days and that's the plan, then after 30 days, you're obligated to mezuzah after 30 days.
And if the landlord doesn't allow you?
So you have an issue on your hands. You have to talk to the landlord somewhere. But do it discreetly. But
because people have offices.
Yeah.
And they don't allow it.
Right.
They can put the mezuzah inside their office, but not outside.
Offices are required.
Right. So again, technically, yeah, offices might be different, but the
because
it's not a place where you live. You know, unless you sleep in your office, which hopefully
there
are people who do that out there, but unless you sleep there, the office would not require a mezuzah. Again, all these things are, it's appropriate to put them up anyways in an office, but it's not an absolute obligation.
Or if you have a home office. Possibly.
Well, home office is kind of considered part of your house, so that would be more of an obligation than like an actual office, an office building. Yeah, right. Right, so I assume he has mezuzah on his dental office. Yeah, that he should have. Okay, again, all these particulars I recommend. If you have issues, ask a rabbi, and we'll check it out. The other issue I didn't mention also is the doorway. People have like arches in their homes, like instead of like a door frame, it's an arch. That's also a questionable obligation. You should put one up without a blessing in a case like that. Again, a lot of details, but I want to get now to because that's not an official door frame, so that's not called. That's questionable. That's called an actual doorway when it's an arch. A door frame meant in the Torah means a door frame, two side posts and a crossbar on top. That's what a door frame means according to Torah law. As soon as you have other shapes, you get into questionable door frames halachically. Okay, so let's think about now. Again, any questions, a lot of details we just went through. Any questions, ask a rabbi. It can be determined whether you need a mezuzah or not. Does it need a blessing or not? Where it should go? Those are all questions that could be asked. Rabbis do make house calls. You can take pictures and email them, whatever it is. People can figure it out.
As far as what the mezuzah itself, the case, is constructed, it can be constructed from anything, correct?
Right, good. So the actual case could be anything. A case itself is not even an obligation. It's just, that's just to keep it protected and look nicer. The obligation is the scroll. And what I did mention, is that there is an idea of having it permanently affixed. So, to put it up with, masking tape is not recommended. Using, a very strong tape or nails, obviously, would be the best to affix your mezuzah. The other option, which we don't really do so much in America these days, is that in Israel, you might notice that certain stone structures actually have the mezuzah. They engrave a little hole in the wall and stick it inside the actual doorpost itself. So that's not so common in America, but you do find that in Israel. they did actually carve out a part of the doorpost and just stick it in the doorpost, literally, instead of fixing on the side of it. And that's also fine to do. So that's the idea of mezuzah. Like in the case itself, you can use it however you like. It's, you know, a nice case. It beautifies the mitzvah, and it protects. And I will just mention practically, mezuzahs that are outside the house, you should be sure the case is something which is waterproof and durable. I had a mezuzah outside, which the case itself is not waterproof, and water got inside, and it got moldy and ruined. So any mezuzah you have on the outside of your home that's exposed to the elements, I do recommend getting a very strong, durable, waterproof case to protect the scroll. So what's the idea? Mezuzah is something which, you know, it's a mitzvah which all of us are aware of. It's a very important mitzvah. What's the concept? You know, why did God command to place this scroll on the side, on the door of our house?
Yeah. I believe one of the main mitzvot is God is one and remember the exit from Egypt.
So that's written in the mezuzah. That's your point.
Two. Did I forget another one?
What?
Did I forget another mitzvah?
Another mitzvah? No, you're trying to answer
the...
Yeah.
And it's Yitzhak, remember.
Okay.
Remember, it's Yitzhak. Am I correct?
Well, Yitzhak Mitzrayim is not in the mezuzah, but it's not in there. Shema is.
Oh, Tefillin, sorry.
Tefillin has it inside, correct.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Right.
So why Yitzhak Mitzrayim is not in the mezuzah?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, I don't know.
That's a good question.
That's a good question. You know, that is a good question. So let's think about that. But the Shema, the first two paragraphs of Shema are in the mezuzah. That's in the mezuzah. So let's just talk about what the idea of the mezuzah may be. So simply, the first simple idea would be the following. And this is said by the commentator on the Torah called the Chizkuni. He writes that you should remember what the mezuzah says as you enter and leave your home. You know, as you walk around, enter a room, leave a room, enter a house, leave a house. It's a constant reminder, as we discussed last week, that we need constant reminders about God. And we're human beings and we get drawn into other ideals, other philosophies in this world, and we have to always be focused on our obligations as Jews, that we focus on God at all times. So the mezuzah is a reminder for us. Every time you walk in the room, you open the door up, and you remember the fundamentals of Judaism. Inside the mezuzah, it talks about the foundations of what it means to be a Jew. That God is one, that you should love God, that you should study the Torah, that God rewards us.
Shema.
Yeah, the Shema, right. God gives us the land of Israel. All these fundamentals are inside the mezuzah. So as we walk in a room, we're supposed to think about these constantly. It gives us also... That's in the third paragraph. It's not in the mezuzah. It's only the first two in the mezuzah. It's also a reminder for us that I have to be sure I act properly both in the house and out of the house. You know, there's some people that in public, they act like they're so pious or they're so honest, so upright. In their homes, they act lousy. Or some are the opposite. Some people, you know, in their homes, you know, they're very, very loyal to God. But when it comes to public, you know, they don't want to look like they're this religious person, and they don't want to, you know, keep to their ideals in public. And it goes both ways. So the mezuzah tells you when you enter the home, when you leave the home, you should be acting in the same way. You're still devoted to being a good Jew, devoted to God, devoted to your own personal ideals, and that's the reminder of the mezuzah. Now, there's a very famous quote from Maimonides, from the Rambam. And the Rambam writes, and it's a very interesting description he gives. He says, when you enter and leave your home, the mezuzah should wake you up from your slumber and from your foolishness, which is caused by, you know, just the rigors of time. Meaning that, you know, as life goes on, many of us fall kind of into a daze. You know, we have times where we're very inspired, and we're very motivated to go out and do and accomplish and do good things and do the right thing. And sometimes we fall just into our routines. We fall into our lazy malaise that we just don't want to do. We just don't do what's right. So the Rambam says the mezuzah serves as a reminder, as a wake-up call, to wake us up. And we should know, he says a very interesting thing. He says we should know that there's nothing in this world which is permanent except for your connection with God. And he says when you think about that concept, you'll immediately get your head on straight. It's my own wording. Get your head on straight, and you'll go in the proper straight ways. So Maimonides teaches us, I think, two things here. Number one is the mezuzah is a wake-up call. I mean, all of us, we see mezuzahs all the time. Walk in, probably one over here. The HCC has mezuzahs up. I'm sure we see mezuzahs around. We just don't think about what they say. But it should be a moment of inspiration. When you look at a mezuzah, you should think about what it says inside, and it should keep us focused to do the right things in life. It's very fascinating. The Rambam describes the blowing of the shofar Rosh Hashanah in a very similar vein. He also says the shofar literally is like an alarm clock. Shofar, you blow, you hear the loud sound, and it should jolt you and wake you up. And the Rambam says the same thing there. The Rambam, Maimonides, tells us that the shofar is supposed to wake you up. Rosh Hashanah, we know, is the day of judgment, and we're supposed to listen to the shofar and be driven to do good and be better people. And he says the mezuzah is the same exact thing. It's a wake-up call for us. It doesn't make a sound like a shofar does. But he says that's the goal of the mezuzah. And the message that it screams at us is the following. You know, in life, we get involved in so many things that we think are real and permanent. People live their lives just to accumulate more and more money. And they say, you know, I'm accomplished, I've gotten so much. But then after 120 years, that money does not go with them into the grave. I mean, we know that. That's something which is obvious to all of us. We know that. It's, you know, it says it in Psalms as well, if we need a source for it. King David tells us, when you die, you don't take it all with you. It doesn't go with you when you die. So we think that our money is something which is of permanence, and we know that deep down we understand that nothing goes with us permanently. You know, the biggest symbol of a person's of permanence in this world is a structure, a home. You know, I think the fact we call it in English real estate, because we think this is something which is real. Other things are kind of like more abstract. This is real. This is it. I can touch it. I can feel it. It's fixed in the ground. I'm not going anywhere. I can't knock it over. You know. Right? Oh, wait. There's another.
I'll check it out.
Okay, we'll do some research on real estate.
But now we have virtual homes.
Virtual homes. What's a virtual home?
Question: is there a link between the mezuzah and the tefillin?
There is. Let me finish this point here. But there is a link for the two. So we think that our homes, a physical building, a structure, as we call them, the brick and mortar building, as they refer to it these days. That's something which we think is, if anything's permanent in this world, that's permanence. But as you walk through the door, the Rambam says, we're supposed to step back and realize, well, this structure is not all that permanent. This structure might be very strong, and it's, you know, it's made out of bricks, and the big bad wolf can't blow it down. You know, we know that. But what happens, that the only thing that actually is permanent in life is that which I accomplish as a Jew, my relationship with God. You know, because that goes with me to the grave. You know, my good reputation, my good deeds, that which I've done to develop myself as a good Jew, that sticks with me permanently. And even after I die, I have that. The money I don't have, the house I don't have, nothing else do I have besides my good deeds, my good name, my good reputation, that goes with me forever. So the Rambam says that the mezuzah is to teach us what is true permanence. Don't think your house is true permanence. True permanence in this world is your what he calls the knowledge of Tzor Olam, the true stone of the world. And he uses the metaphor of he calls God a stone, because a stone is also a symbol of something which is a permanence. So the true stone of the world is God. He's the Tzur HaOlam, the stone of the world. And we have to recognize what is truly permanent and what is only, you know, fleeting. It puts us in the right frame of mind. You know, that we should work in life to achieve things that are permanent and not things that we're going to lose after a short period of time. Whether that short period is a week or it's 120 years of life, eventually, that's nothing in terms of eternity. I like to say, I'm not sure if this is what it actually means, but I like to say an understanding of the prayer that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, says on Yom Kippur. We know in Yom Kippur, the high priest will enter into the holiest room in the whole world, the Holy of Holies, Kodesh HaKadoshim. And when he was in there, he didn't want to stay in too long, because if you do something wrong in there, it could be dangerous. People were concerned for his well-being. Because if you go in that room, you got to be 100% focused and doing what's right. But the rabbis teach us a few prayers that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, said when he went into the Holy of Holies. And one of the prayers, I always found this to be kind of random or strange. One of the prayers he said was that it was known the people who built their homes in a certain area of Israel, the ground there was not very stable. And it would happen every once in a while that their homes would collapse because the foundation wasn't strong. The Anshei HaSharon, people lived in the Sharon. Right? In Sharon. So it says that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, would pray. He'd say that their home should not become their graves. That's what he would say. So literally meaning that their homes are not built on stable land and they could collapse, God forbid, and crush the people. But I always like to understand it more symbolically. Because, you know, if this is a prayer the high priest says on Yom Kippur, the holiest moments, the holiest room in the world, the holiest person in the world saying this prayer, must have a little deeper meaning to it. So So I like to understand the prayer that, you know, we also like to live our lives that way. We don't want our homes, meaning we don't want our physical possessions to become that which buries us. You know, some people get totally overwhelmed or sucked in to materialism and to money and to their houses. And because of that, they miss out on the true important things in life. So you can call that also your home becoming your grave, that a person becomes buried by their physical possessions and their material accomplishments, and misses out on true goodness in this world and true accomplishment. So I always like to understand that to be part of the deeper meaning of the prayer of the Kohen Gadol, that we don't want our homes to become our graves. We make sure that our material accomplishments and our money and our physical accomplishments do not become that which totally overtakes our lives and buries us. But so the Rambam is telling us a very fascinating thing, that mezuzah is to teach us this lesson, that you walk in your home and you look at the strong doorpost and you look at the bricks and you touch it. It's like, this is something which is so permanent and so real, and you're supposed to look at the mezuzah and say, no, that's not permanence. This is something I'm supposed to enjoy during my time in this world. But true permanence and true eternity comes through good deeds, connection with God, study of Torah, and that's true eternity and true permanence. So that's one symbolism of mezuzah. A related symbolism is the following. And this is said by a different commentator called the Sefer HaCharedim. He says the following thing. He says that when you enter a home, you touch your mezuzah, and there's a concept of giving it a touch or a kiss, which some people do, and then that kind of focuses you in on what it's supposed to say inside. And you touch the mezuzah, and you enter your house, and you recognize who is the real master of the house. We think we're the masters of the house. We think this is our house, and we've worked hard, and we've bought it, and we pay the mortgage payments, and we make sure that we keep the upkeep of the house proper. But we have to realize that all of that we do have comes from a greater master of the house. The one who truly owns our homes, the one who gives us our possessions, is God. God we refer to in prayers as Kone HaKol, one who acquires it all. He's the one who acquires the heavens and the earth. He's the owner of the world. And we're merely guests in God's world. That's what we are. And it's also something we have to think about occasionally, because or else, you know, our possessions can go to our heads. We can become arrogant. We cannot have gratitude for what we do have. We don't appreciate that God gives us so much. And one does have a home. I mean, a home is an amazing thing. There are people out there who, God forbid, they're homeless. And it's a terrible thing. To appreciate that you have a home, and that home came from somewhere besides your own wallet, but it came from God who gave you that kindness, that's a very important understanding to have, that we have a home and God is the master of the world. God's the master of the house. And we're guests. We are the guests in God's world and in God's home. It happens to be, as an aside, that's one of the concepts of Shabbos. Shabbos is a day we're supposed to refrain from work. Now why is that? Because we're supposed to step back and say that I don't own the world. If it was my world, I can do whatever I want with it. But God says, no, not so fast. This is my world, and today I don't want you to tamper with my world today. So it's like when I have a guest coming and staying in my home for a few days. So they'll only do what they ask me, if it's a good guest. So they'll say, is it okay if I take something out of the refrigerator? Do you mind if I sit on the couch and read this book? You know, is it okay if I go into this room? Because they know it's not their house, and they want to be sure that I give permission for it. So if I tell the guest, well, it's okay today to use the refrigerator, but tomorrow I don't want you to go in there, they have to listen, because you're the master of the house. You're the host. So the idea of Shabbos is that God says, one day a week, I'm letting you know that I'm the master of this world, and today I don't want you to mess with anything. Today, just hands off today. Every other day, God says, okay, I'm giving you permission, you're welcome to use the world, and to build, and to accomplish, and you know, do what you have to do. But one day a week, hands off, because I want you to recognize that this world has a boss, has an owner, and that owner is God. So mezuzah is that same idea, that the mezuzah teaches us that the true master of the house isn't me, it's God. That's what the mezuzah is supposed to teach us. There's another concept, before we get to that, I know you like gematrias, Daniel. The numerical value of mezuzah. Mezuzah, Hebrew, mem, zayin, vav, zayin, hey. That, the numerical value of that is 65.
How much?
65. And that's the same exact numerical value as the word Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, Adonai, name of God. Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. Because that's all 65. Because mezuzah itself is supposed to clue us in to the master. The word Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, Adonai, that means the master. That's what it means.
Aleph,
Nun, Yud. It's the way you pronounce God's name. So that word means my master. And the mezuzah is supposed to clue us in to who is our master. That's what mezuzah does for us. Another classic commentary, Rabbeinu Bechaya, So he writes another interesting idea. He says that we all, if you look at your mezuzah, so the way you're supposed to wrap the scroll is that the actual paragraphs are on the inside of the scroll. And on the outside, you have one of God's names, Shaddai, Shin Dalad Yud. That's on the outside. So look at your mezuzah, and that's supposed to actually be on the outside, in the front, you can see it, that word, Shin Dalad Yud. So what does that name represent? You know, God has many names, we call him. And one of the meanings of the name of Shin Dalad Yud, Shaddai, one of the meanings of that name is that God overturns nature. The word is related to the word shodeid, which is to plunder something. And the rabbis teach us it means that God can plunder the systems of nature. So we have nature, and we have the way the world runs, and then God can come in and overturn all of that, because God's in control of it all. Shodeid. Right? Shodeid is the word they use. Shin vav dalad dalad. Shodeid. So Shaddai is related to Shodeid. 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 Is that a word in modern Ivrit? Shodeid?
The last letter is Dalad?
Yeah.
It's like a robber.
A robber.
Shodeid.
Yeah. Okay. So that's so. Plunder. You have to plunder something. Yeah, that's what we're saying. Shodeid. So the word that they use, Shodeid ma'arachot ha-teva. That's the word. Shodeid ma'arachot ha-teva. Right. Those are the plunderers of the night, the robbers of the night. Yeah, so...
Is it wrapped with this plastic paper to protect it? Is it kosher to do that?
That's okay, yeah. That's actually recommended because it protects it. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's recommended to do because it keeps it much more protected. So so that name of God tells us that there's nature and then there's God who overturns nature. And that's on the mezuzah. So Rabbeinu Bachaya teaches us that, and it's along a similar vein we've discussed before, that people think that their success is based on nature. You know, I was born and I worked and I got a job and I made some money and I bought a house and I was going along with, you know, the way people live their lives naturally, and that's why I succeeded in having a home. But we know that's not so simple, because there are people who are born and they go to college and they get a degree and they try to get a job and they fail, they can't get a job, they lose their job and they can't afford a home. So we have to understand that really God runs the world in supernatural ways, and the mezuzah shows us that having this home is something which you can't view as natural. The fact that I merited a home is something which comes from God. And that's the name which is on the mezuzah, the name Shaddai, that actually implies that God is the one who overturns nature, and he's the one who's able to come in and control the world and show us that I'm giving you this home. There's an address on the home is supposed to be designated for you. The Talmud actually says that homes are predestined for a person even before they're born. It's a very interesting thing. It's spoken about, you know, it says that before a person's born, there's a voice that comes out from heaven and says, "Bayis ploni l'ploni." This home will belong to that person. Yeah, it's actually the same exact section in the Talmud. You know, or change your wife, right?
So,
unless it's predestined that you'll have this house until this age, and then you move on to another house, they're different, you know? I don't know, but that's what it says. So, homes are predestined from God, what Talmud tells us. Now, the other meaning of mezuzah, which I think are more aware of, which is more commonly known, is mezuzah is actually considered a protection of the home. It protects us. It's something which is found in the Talmud in a few places. I'll read you a source in the Talmud about how mezuzah protects us. But mezuzah is supposed to stand for the fact that God protects the Jewish home. The name we mentioned before, the name of God, Shaddai, some say is an acronym, Shin Dalad Yud. It's for Shomer Dalsos or Daltot Yisrael. God guards the doorways of Israel. Shomer Daltot Yisrael. So God is the one who guards our doorways. And the Talmud records, there's actually two different quotes I'll read to you. It says that it's a mitzvah to place the mezuzah in the section of the door close to the street, so that when a person enters the home, they will see the mezuzah immediately. And then another opinion says, so that it will guard their homes. And the Rabbi Hanina teaches us that you come and see that God is not like a human being, because a king of flesh and blood sits inside his palace, and his servants protect him. But for us, it's the opposite. Our King God protects our homes. We're the servants, and God protects us. So the mezuzah is there, the gotcha protect us. And in the Talmud cites a verse in Tehillim in Psalms, it says that God is the one who guards you, He is your shadow on your right hand. Hashem silcha yad yaminecha. So the mezuzah is supposed to be a protection on the home as well. Which is why there is a concept that even if you have technically have a place that is that's exempt from the mezuzah, people put one up anyways, because even if you're exempt, it still is a protection. And that is, there are sources for that. Not the mezuzah. A mezuzah, you know, if you do a mitzvah, that won't bring you bad. I mean, it's not invincible. If you have a mezuzah up, things could happen to the person inside as well. But it's not. It doesn't make your home like impenetrable. You know, it doesn't do that. So if someone inside is not acting appropriately, then God may still bring punishment to the person. But the mezuzah, if it's there, is always a good thing. It's never a bad thing to have a mezuzah. Right. So it could be for a lot of things. It could be evil eye. It could be, you know, or more physical things also. I mean, it could be that God will protect your home from physical ailments because of that as well. The elements.
Like mold.
You know, it could be. You know, if it's a protection of the home, they can protect from many different things. That's the idea of Shomer Daltot Yisrael. There's actually some point out that the word mezuzot, you can rearrange the letters to spell Zaz Mavis, move away death. And it drives away death from the home. That's what it can do. There's another source of this as well, that if you look at where the discussion of mezuzah is in the Torah, which is in chapter 11 of the book of Devarim, so it says you should put up your mezuzah, the second paragraph of Shema. You should put up a mezuzah, and then it says, Laman yirbu yameichem, so that you shall have lengthy days. So the commentary, Baal HaTurim, he writes that we see a mezuzah helps one have lengthy days. So it's a protection on a person, even on their health, it sounds like. It's a protection for a person. Again, it's not you know, that you have a mezuzah up and suddenly you're invincible. But it's something that does provide a person protection for who they are, for their homes, for their health. It's something which is very positive for a person to have up for protection reasons, beyond the fact that it's a command from God and an obligation. There's another story I can tell you. I'll tell you two more stories, and one with this. One story is a famous story about a convert named Unklus. This is also quoted in the Talmud. Unklus was a Roman convert, it seems. He was actually a leader to the Roman royal family. And he converted to Judaism. And, sorry, I found the right page for this. And the Talmud records that Unklus, the son of Clonimus, he became a convert. And the Caesar, who I think was his uncle or something, the Caesar sent a troop of Romans after him. They wanted to bring him back into Roman culture and get away from these Jews. So the first people came to him, and he had a theological debate with these Roman soldiers, and he actually converted them to Judaism himself. So he actually debated with them, and he convinced them, and they became Jews. Okay, so that didn't work. So we'll get to that part. That's why I'm reading the story. So the next thing is the Caesar sent a second troop, a group of soldiers to get him. And he told the second group, don't speak to him. Just go there and take him back, and don't talk to the guy. That's what he told them. So the soldiers come to Unklus, and Unklus opens conversation and says, I'll tell you something. And he says, well, I know, and he goes through a whole list of people. Basically, he says that I know that people of lower rank, they're the ones who hold the torch for those of higher rank. I mean, if you're walking at night, so who's going to hold the torch for you? There's someone who's a lower rank than you in the army. And he says, well, who holds the light for the king? And they say, well, usually one of the lower soldiers would do this. They answered him. You know, they weren't supposed to, but he asked the questions, they answered his question. So then he said to them, well, I'll tell you that for us it's the opposite, because God is the one who holds the light for us. So even though usually the lower level soldier holds the light for the officer, when it comes to Jews, God lights the world for us, as it says that God went in front of us in the desert. He had the pillar of fire and the clouds of the desert, which led us to the desert after we left Egypt. So after that conversation, these soldiers were convinced and they also converted. So then the Caesar sent a third group of soldiers, and he said, don't talk to him at all, nothing, you know. So they get there, and they saw the mezuzah on the doorway. And Well, yeah, sorry, I missed a step. They grabbed him, and they started pulling him out of the house, and as they're pulling him out of the house, Unklus touched the mezuzah. And he said to them, what is this? And they said, I don't know, you tell us. Right? So they didn't know what it was. So he said, you know, typically in the world, a king, like we said before, a king sits inside his palace, and his servants guard him. But for Jews, we sit in our home, and God, our king, he guards us. So after he told them this, they converted to him. So that was the third group. But we see that he was being able to bring out this important point. We have to recognize and appreciate that God guards Jewish homes. And it's not typical that a king sits guard outside his servants' homes, but God is the one who protects all of us. And the mezuzah stands for us as a symbol that God is our protection. That's the mezuzah. And this one other quick story is there's another story about a man named, I'll find his name for you. There's a man named Artavan. And it's a dispute who this man was. Some say he was actually a Persian ruler, and some say he was a wealthy Jew. So different commentaries say differently. But whoever he was, he doesn't seem to be all that knowledgeable. And he sent a gift to the great leader, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who was the leader of the Jews at the time. And he sent him a gem, a very expensive gem. And he told Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he said, send me back a gift which is equivalent to this gem. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi sent back a mezuzah to this guy, Artavan. So the guy said, I don't understand. I sent you this gem, which is priceless. You sent me this piece of paper? Like, I don't understand why you sent this to me. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi told him, you know, that everything that I desire in life and everything that you have in life is nowhere near as valuable as this mezuzah. Why? So simply because we look at any mitzvah, something which is priceless, any mitzvah, something which is eternal, and any gem you send me cannot equal this mezuzah. And furthermore, what you sent me, I have to protect. You get a diamond ring, you have to get an insurance policy on, you have to know where you put it, it's not so simple. But what I sent you will protect you. And that's why my gift is much greater than your gift. That's what he tells him. So we see the power of mezuzah to be a protection for a person, for a Jewish home. And that's one of the, I guess, more famous and powerful ideas about mezuzah. So mezuzah is supposed to be for us a symbol of what is permanent and what's not permanent. It should be for us a symbol that who is the true master of our homes. And it should be for us as a protection to protect our homes and recognize that God is the one who protects the Jewish home. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, like, when you go in there, it's an idol, you're supposed to see it, it's supposed to remind the person of the mitzvah and to lead a holy life. That's what, I think, the basic idea is. You see it, it reminds you. Okay, you have to be like a good person, you have to
right.
Do the mitzvah. So now it's like these stories are like turning it around. It's there and it's guarding you. But isn't that's kind of a nice twist, but isn't the real purpose to have the impact on the person so they should be...
Well, they could both be true. I'm saying I think they're all true. I'm saying these are all ideas which they're all part of the idea of mezuzah. It goes both ways. We're supposed to be inspired by it and it should be a protection for us. It goes both ways. Yeah. Right, okay, yeah, that's something.
We took our mezuzah.
There is a concept.
House to Israel, and he knew everything about us.
He read what?
He read the mezuzah. He looked at our mezuzah.
And he checked them?
No, like reading tea leaves.
That's Kabbalistic.
He read them and helped.
Yeah, and he knew exactly, you know, our issues and what was going on in our lives. Well. Without ever having met us before. And he did it for many people.
Well.
Since it's in the Torah, right?
Right.
Is there some, like, an original description of what Hashem had in mind when he wanted us to do this? Or we're reading all of these levels of people who have made up their ideas about what it is. Is there a real basic foundational
answer? I'm happy to also. I think the way you're putting it, that they made up ideas along the way, is the wrong way to look at it. I mean, we look at, God gave us the verse in the Torah which says, put up a mezuzah.
Right.
And then along with that came oral tradition. And the oral tradition contains within it midrash ideas, Kabbalistic ideas.
What's the earliest oral tradition?
Well, that we have recorded is Mishnah, but I'm saying that was oral until that point. It came from Mount Sinai. So God said, here's the mitzvah, and here's, I'm giving you orally all the explanations. So as time went on, different commentators were able to bring those out, elaborate on them, you know, drive them home to us. But it was all part of the original body of Torah given to the Jews at Mount Sinai. So all these ideas, it wasn't like in the year 1200, Rabbeinu Bechaya just made this up one day. He was looking at earlier sources that trace themselves back to the oral tradition in Mount Sinai. That's what he's looking at.
The premise here, that along with the written Torah at Sinai, Moshe Rabbeinu was given the entire oral Torah.
Right.
And it explains, there's a lot of places in the written Torah where you can't really understand what it means. So there is this official explanation. Now this has been denied by the Sadducees, by the Karaites, by various modern versions of Judaism over the centuries, but the teaching here is according to the traditional teaching. You don't have to agree with it, but that's the teaching basis here.
We didn't learn about it in the year 1300 because somebody decided to make a decision about it.
The theory is...
I wanted to know how far back can we go to the written, to the oral Torah. I'm saying
that these sources I'm reading, such as the Midrash, Mishnah, were recorded around the year, I think, let's say 200-something.
They already felt they had to give up on keeping it orally because it was being forgotten.
The year 200 is good. I think that's close to the time.
Yeah, but it was in existence way before that. It was only written down.
Oh, I know that.
He's just saying, my point was... Well, it says, write these words on your house. And the paragraph is said in the Shema. That's the paragraph of the Shema.
So it's the paragraph after the commandment of the mezuzah?
Yeah, well, it's in that paragraph. In Shema, we say, Uchtav tama mezuzah betecha visharecha, right? So what's these words? These words mean the words that you just read, the words of Shema. That's what it means.
You know that in Israel, we live most of the time in Israel.
Right. Right.
And you know what? Non-religious people, with shorts, with their openness clothed, with whatever you can imagine, when they walk into the supermarket, they kiss the mezuzah.
Right. It's part of what it means to